Welcome to this special Think Tank edition of Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. You're about to hear the thoughts and visions of 12 clinical investigators specializing in this disease. My co-chair for this annual adventure in controversy was Dr. Rich Goldberg, and the theme was the clinical implications of recently reported research databases, particularly the 2007 ASCO meeting in June. To begin, we focused on management of elderly patients, and Dr. Goldberg, who co-authored a May 2007 JCO review article on this topic, began the discussion.
I'm now treating a lady in my practice who, at 82, we decided not to give adjuvant therapy for. She had 15 positive nodes. Now I'm treating her with the same regimen in the advanced disease setting, wondering if, had I treated her earlier, I could have delayed or eliminated her recurrence. Probably not, but she's getting the same therapy, only she's 2 years older.
Charlie?
We're talking about examples of people that are well over 70. I mean, I think I can understand why drawing the line in the analysis at 70, because we don't have a lot of 80-year-olds in our clinical trials.
Correct.
But to some extent, I think 70 to 75 is less informative and maybe less of a dilemma for a practicing oncologist. I think when you get past that, that's where they really need to know, is this a population that benefits?
Howard? We, in ECOG 1299, that was a study of UFT in elderly patients with colorectal cancer, but they all had to be older than 75. So the oldest one was 89. The median age in that study was 79 years old. And the toxicity and response rate is exactly the same as in the CO6 data. There was no increased toxicity. There were 11 patients between 85 and 90, and they did have a little higher incidence of toxicity. But the 75 to 80 and the 80 to 85 group did not have more toxicity.
Dan?
This is an instance where journals should publish the eligibility criteria, for example, and the dose mods for the protocol so you can understand the generalizability of the data. I mean, we're talking about the fit elderly population, an even smaller proportion than the 10% of people who enter clinical trials in general. So I think it's true that the fit elderly over 80 who entered intergroup 089 were 121 patients of the total 3,800 patients. And you could say that they didn't do much worse. But what percent of those 80-year-olds were they?
It's very difficult to use tools like Adjuvant Online, whatever, to really capture all the factors that we take into account when we make an assessment for a patient. I had a 92-year-old patient recently who I looked at the nose, thought, you know, impossible, would never give her adjuvant chemotherapy for her 1 or 2 lymph node positive colon cancer. I looked at her, entered the room, and immediately the impression was she's 20 years younger. And so capturing the impression in a score or whatever, I think that's our challenge for clinical trials, whatever, because we see a select group of patients.
Joel?
And when they've tried to analyze some of these elderly studies, the problem is always who gets into the study in the first place. And there's a huge amount of selection. If you look at the data for radiation that I know about for adjuvant treatment, and you look at Medicare populations, as the population gets older, a smaller percentage of patients get adjuvant therapy, and I'm sure the same thing is true for any adjuvant modality. And what goes into those decision-makings is, as Axel was saying, very, very unclear. It's very subjective. I don't think there's any doubt that for any of these, the fit elderly can do very well. It's also true that some of the sort of fit elderly, you do some stuff to them, and they're not so fit anymore.
Right. Rich?
Well, what I was really interested in trying to do with this was, first of all, to get the data, and then to try and open oncologists' minds to considering more aggressive therapy in people that they might not have considered it in before. The other thing I would say is this isn't an all-or-nothing thing. And often in my practice, if I'm worried that somebody might not tolerate the treatment well, I'll give them LV5FU2 for the first cycle. And then if they come back in and they said, you know, I didn't notice I got chemo, I'll give them Oxali, and the first time I might give them 60 per meter squared instead of 85 or 100. So you can grade your approach to the individual patient without saying, you know, I'm going to either be aggressive or I'm going to be unaggressive in that individual.
You also have capecitabine, which we know a lot of people start using more in older people. Bob?
I think the most important point is I agree absolutely with this eyeball test, but patients sort of select themselves in terms of, do you want to aim high and work down? Do you want to aim low and work up? I think the most important thing for the practicing oncologist is when the elderly or the frail start to go south, they can go south fairly quickly. So in my practice, if we make a decision to treat or treat with combination therapy, it's more about how closely you watch those patients. And if you keep your eye on them very closely, I mean, we'll have weekly visits with some of these patients. You can at least, until you know that they're going to be okay, because once they start to get sick, it's usually a big snowball and they're in the hospital and you have a lot of regret.
Lee?
Just coming from a different perspective, I think medical oncologists have a little bit of a luxury where you can change course midstream. Oftentimes when these patients come in to a surgeon and they're 80, 82 years old and they have colon cancer, unless it's a complex operation like a pelvic exent or a concomitant liver resection or whatever, typically we have to make sure they're as good as they can get for surgery, and we operate, and knock on wood, the mortality and the morbidity is relatively low. You do have a select group of patients who don't do well, but most of these patients don't have a choice. Whereas in oncology, you can alter your strategy midstream. So I think that the ultimate stress actually is surgery. And once they've passed that test, especially for the folks around the table who are delivering the adjuvant chemotherapy, I think they've already passed a significant stress test.
Charlie?
You know, it's interesting because I think for the particularly older patients, we use our experience and our gestalt, which is certainly relevant. It would be nice to have something more definitive that we could give to practitioners. And, you know, if you think about it, the cardiologists and anesthesiologists do this. I mean, we think it's not age. We think it's comorbid disease and performance status and maybe a few other things like laboratory parameters. One could potentially try to collect that data in trials and start to understand what are the predictors for an older person who wouldn't do well.
Norm?
Yeah, I was going to have a follow-up question for Dr. Hoekster in his elderly population that you treated. I mean, what happened when the elderly got a grade 3 and 4 toxicity? I mean, how well did they fare compared to a population that we'd consider less elderly? The analogy from Dr. Ellis that, you know, if an elderly patient can tolerate an operation, this is a great stress, but they don't tolerate complications as well as a younger population.
Howard?
Well, I don't have any specific comparison to, for example, the CO6 morbidity or mortality. The incidence of grade 3, 4 toxicity wasn't worse, and I don't think that we had an increased number of deaths on the trial. We're learning what people in geriatrics have already learned, that it is the functional status, and they have a few tools to understand what the functional status of the patient is, but it's stuff like the mini mental status exam and how far they can walk and things like that, which may not be so predictive for us in terms of giving chemotherapy. So I agree with Charlie, that would be a great thing if we could come up with a little nomogram or small test to see who's going to be chemo tolerant.
We're dissecting age, we're dissecting age and sex, we're dissecting, you know, PS and the nuances of it, and yet the broad strokes we didn't really discuss to the point that I think we ought to have. I mean, I think that these papers really have made us focus on the fact that age is not a discriminant relative to the benefit from chemotherapy, and neither is PS. And I think that's the take-home message from this.
And I believe that those are messages that are practically applicable in my clinic every day.
I think there's a real difference in the way people in the community practice, though, because they put a much higher value on safety for many of these treatments. I mean, the worst thing you can do in practice is make somebody really sick, because the patient gets mad at you, your nurses really get mad at you, and it makes your life miserable because you have to take care of them instead of the house staff. I think we can approach patients sometimes in a little different manner, but I think for most people who have large clinical practices, first do no harm, let's put it that way, is a lot more important than the data is sometimes. So I think our job is to really clarify that for patients and for the treating physicians in the community to make them more comfortable that they aren't going to make people sick.
I feel blood pressure is going up all across the country on the roads of America listening to that. Neil?
I'd like to respond to Howard's and actually add some evidence in this regard. We did a study across the state of Pennsylvania of oncologists and their patients, asking them about what their barriers were to participating in clinical trials. And we asked both the doctors and patients to rank 7 potential barriers as being most important to least important. And the most important barrier for patients was potential for side effects and concern for side effects from therapy on a clinical trial. The doctors ranked fear of side effects much lower. So there was this disconnect between what the doctors perceived as being important to patients vis-a-vis clinical trial participation and what the patients thought. So I think this really underscores what you're saying, that patients are very concerned about side effects, and that might impact decisions about selecting therapy in different clinical settings.
Dan?
And also, very quickly, that if you use hazard ratios and relative risk reductions across the board, it may look the same in the younger person and the older person, but aging and comorbidities are a continuum. So if you look at Malcolm Moore's slides that he's shown relative to aging, a 20% risk reduction in an 80-year-old may be a very different absolute difference than in a 30-year-old. And so people need to be told both.
Rich?
I just wanted to make the point that I think that every oncologist has to make a decision with every patient. Am I going to be aggressive or am I going to be homeopathic? And my bias is that if you're going to treat somebody, in general, you often ought to be aggressive because the drugs work best when you push the doses, and that it's absolutely proper to make a decision not to treat somebody, but to half treat somebody may protect the patient from toxicity, but also protect them from benefit.
There's also getting the patient involved in the decision. Charlie?
You know, I agree with Rich. Neil, I appreciate the fact that patients are concerned about side effects, as they should be, but I don't know that they're less concerned about their survival, whether it be in the metastatic setting or the adjuvant setting. So I think we have to be a little careful. Certainly the principle is to do no harm, but if we have a proven benefit for a therapy and it benefits people over the age of 75 or 80, even if the absolute difference isn't quite as great, I think we shouldn't overlook that. And the other important statistic is that an 80-year-old person in this country, I think, has another 11 years on average to live.